Welcome to the Biology of Trauma podcast, the show that provides professionals with the knowledge and tools for effective, science-based solutions for the trauma healing journey. I am your host, Dr. Amy, and I've done the hard work so you can stop your endless searching, have a roadmap for your own work, and be able to help others more powerfully. Welcome to this episode of the Biology of Trauma podcast. I am your host, Dr. Amy. And it's always so meaningful for me to bring you information and teaching on attachment, because if you know my story, you would know this is where it all started for me. But putting on my physician hat, here's why it's important for me. Your attachment literally impacts every area of your life, your relationships, nervous system, health, coping mechanisms, all of it. Attachment influences the way you form and maintain relationships, or the way you don't maintain relationships, your communication style, and even the way that we express our needs and emotions, or the fact that we don't express our needs and emotions, all of that is coming back to attachment. Not only that, research has now shown that individuals with insecure attachment styles experience more mental health issues, chronic stress, and physical health problems. In this episode, we're going to talk about some of those. And the reason why is because attachment is closely linked to our nervous system and its regulation or dysregulation, which is directly related to the regulation or dysregulation of our physical health, of our biology at the cellular level. And so the one question that we're going to focus and answer in this episode is, what are the specific survival adaptations of our nervous system when early connection was not always safe? I'm excited to have a guest join me for this episode, Dr. Diane Poolheller. She is an internationally recognized speaker, author, and has been a real leader in the field of trauma and attachment. And here's what you will learn in this episode. How do we define attachment based on our biology? How does the nervous system get confused when connection isn't always safe when we were young? What are the markers and milestones to indicate we are moving towards a secure attachment? What does it mean when we ghost people? And why we can't just think our way out of attachment and relationship patterns? How to build new relational skills for connection and authenticity? And in this interview, this is going to be something unique because you may never have thought of attachment as relating to your physical health. And yet that's exactly what it does. And I'm going to show you why. I'm going to create the context for you. And then we're going to jump into this interview. First of all, to understand attachment, there's actually a biology of attachment. So just like there's a biology of trauma, there is a biology of attachment. And what exactly is attachment? After you take the 21-day journey, then it opens up the biology of trauma modules for you. And one of those modules that I teach is the biology of attachment and neurodevelopment. So neurodevelopment and attachment are things that happen in early life, and they either will generate a secure attachment, meaning your nervous system, your operating system, your programming for life, for relationships, for your health is either one of security and safety, or guess what? Of trauma, fear, and disease. So what is attachment? It is the combination of attunement, which is the nonverbal communication and attention that a primary caregiver has with their infant. We're talking about really early life, pre-verbal. So that nonverbal communication and responsiveness, we call that attunement. And the degree of autonomic regulation. So again, these words of regulation of our autonomic nervous system, not necessarily just of our central nervous system, which is our brain, but our autonomic nervous system. So that vagus nerve, that sympathetic nerve chain that runs our operating system. So how regulated are we coming out of early childhood? And what was the degree of attunement? That is what will generate, that is what will result in our attachment style, whether one of insecure attachment, and if it's insecure, which one of the insecure attachment styles, or are we coming out of childhood with a secure attachment? Now, the one other thing that I need you to know as we go into this talk about attachment is that there are biology factors, meaning that there are biology factors, whether you, some of them are genetic, some of them are not genetic, but they're still biological, that impact your attachment style. So that no matter how much therapy or how much trauma work you're doing, you're still noticing yourself in that place of sensitivity, reactivity, and insecurity. So on this important topic of attachment style and attachment trauma, I am so happy to bring my friend, my good friend and colleague, Dr. Diane Poolheather. And let's jump into this interview on attachment style and attachment trauma and the physical health conditions that you can experience with the different types of insecure attachment styles. Diane, it's been fascinating to see the different attachment styles and what we can learn about them. And I think even helping people understand themselves better as they understand why they do what they do based on their nervous system and being able to understand that it's their nervous system. So what have you seen that the different attachment styles do differently in order to help regulate their autonomic nervous system?
That's a really great question. I think really helpful information for all of us to have. First of all, we regulate really deeply through connection with other people, right? That's one of the fastest ways we can regulate is having the touch of a safe friend or, you know, calling somebody up when we're stressed. I mean, social connection is a really big part of how we safely and easily regulate our nervous systems. We're biologically oriented to connection. So when connection is a little bit disturbed by early attachment deficits or whatever the environment did or didn't provide, that will sometimes affect how we are able to access healthy relationship, like secure attachment people in our lives and actually receive that connection that helps us regulate. Or if we're in a relationship with someone else that has insecure attachment, how we might actually dysregulate each other in connection. So it's an important topic and kind of a really relevant question for health in general, that we are healthier when we have good, reliable connections in our life. That doesn't mean we don't love alone time. I mean, I love alone time too, but that we also are able to receive the nourishment of good, healthy connection. And the attachment styles, when we think about secure, which is what we all try to like move our attachment style towards, and it can heal. I really want to start out with that. It's a very hopeful message. We can move and do practices that really help us increase our capacity and our functioning in secure attachment. So this is a very doable practice. It's a very doable healing journey. And I want everybody to hear that first. And then we want to look at what happens when our attachment system gets a little bit off because of either our parents had a certain deficits they were not able to conquer. You know, we have attachment patterns and how we parent and how we receive parenting as children passed down through the generations really easily. So we're not about blame. This is all about how do we all move ourselves more towards a healthy way to connect. And when a child has adapted away from secure attachment, which is, I think we're biologically designed for secure attachment. That's why when we start the healing process, you can see markers for secure attachment returning, like being able to ask for your needs easily or feeling safe in connection, but also autonomous in your alone time, being able to regulate your nervous system easily, self-regulation and co-regulation with another person. So we look at what's healthy first and, you know, feeling safe in relationship, having playfulness, being able to have a sense of humor, all sorts of things that make up secure attachment. When we have a dose or a mix sometimes of insecure attachment styles, what that might look like for a nervous system regulation, which is your original question. When we move and adapt away from secure attachment due to maybe birth trauma, it's not always caretaking. Sometimes it's medical or our temperament or just what our parents were able to do or not do in caregiving. When we move away in the direction of avoidant attachment, that's called avoidant for when we're kids and it's called dismissive when we're adults. We tend to prefer being isolated because we didn't really experience the relationship as nourishing. It was either kind of rejecting or nobody was home, no presence there. And for an infant to reach out to connect for nourishment and they have the experience of their caregiver being dissociated or just not there, that's very frightening. So the child starts to build an internal working model, internal sense of attachment as it's really not very nourishing to have another person. It's actually disturbing. So they start to be self-reliant before we're actually able to be self-reliant. It's not possible for infants to be self-reliant. And that's called a moving towards avoidant attachment. I'm giving you kind of the brief overview here. And what will happen in terms of nervous system regulation is the child will try to do it themselves. They're trying not to rely on this biologically determined need for connection, which is a biological thing, just like getting hungry for food or thirsty for water. This is a really important instinctual drive. So to shut that down takes a lot of energy, and it's also really difficult. But what they'll try to do in regulating is what some people, like Stan Takin, refers to it as auto-regulation, meaning self-regulation, but it's not real self-regulation. It's not an embodied self-regulation. It's more like we all regulate a little bit to watching too much Netflix or doing something that doesn't really involve another person, like, I don't know, getting caught up in computer games or maybe pornography or whatever. We're trying to sort of trance out. Even meditation can be really embodied and really transformative, or it can be checking out. There's a very big difference, right? So if we're just checking out, that is a form of attempted self-regulation. But if you're not embodied, if you're not home here in our physical fleshy self, right, it can be a bit regulating. It's just not true self-regulation. It's more of a, almost a defense versus an actual, really, most healthy and most beneficial kind of regulation. When you're self-regulated, you can feel your body, you can feel stress release, you can feel your tissues and your bones. Like right now, as you're listening, you can see if you feel your feet on the floor or your seat on the chair. Notice if you're feeling warm or cold, or maybe there's a little tension in your neck and you feel more relaxed in your feet. There's sort of different exercises you can do to strengthen your awareness. And that's something that someone with avoidant attachment might have more of a struggle with. They have a little bit harder time connecting to other people because they're early template or blueprint is that other people aren't nourishing, or they're neglectful, or they're actually painful because they're rejecting. So they tend to have a sort of a defense against that. Doesn't mean they don't have friends, but they will have a lot more hesitation sometimes to reach out for a need or to really co-regulate. So they tend to do this auto-regulation, which is more like what disembodied, or you could almost call it dissociative. I mean, you really can call it dissociative, actually. So we want to move from dissociation back to embodiment. And then to continue to answer your question, it's not a short answer. Ambivalent attachment is sort of when parents were there, but they were kind of there inconsistently and unreliably, so that when a child starts to connect with them, they have the experience of it doesn't last long enough and they feel like they're nervous about when the parent's going to drop out. So they have a lot of anxiety. And so they don't really find the parent coming. They'll find it soothing for a moment, but then they'll be immediately worried about fear of separation or fear of abandonment. So there's usually a lot of anxiety, and they need a lot of reassurance from the outside that the parent's going to be there, going to pick them up from school, going to pick them up again when they come back to reconnect. And so they actually are quite anxious, and they're kind of, if you think about avoidant attachment, they're really focused on the self because others don't feel like they're even there, or they're there in a negative way. In ambivalent attachment, which as an adult is called preoccupied, they have the experience of it's really unstable. This connection is really unstable. Sometimes it's really great, and sometimes they just feel energetically dropped. So they have this excessive fear of abandonment. So they over-focus on the other person. They're always trying to like figure out, how do I connect to this person and keep the connection going? So they have a lot of hyper overactive attachment cues for trying to keep the relationship stable. And what I want people to understand is, compassionately for ourselves and for other people that we're in relationships with, is that this is happening so early that we don't even have an ego structure there to make a story about it. Kind of in implicit memory and encoded in your body, it's a natural knee-jerk reaction to relationship. And that so often what's happening in adult relationships that we give each other a hard time for, if we really understand the biology behind it, we drop blame. You know, we just start to understand these are patterns that happen really early. And we start to think about how we can support the person, ourselves or our partners or our kids or our friends, to move towards secure attachment when their attachment system is activated in an insecure way. So that's a very different approach. And so, I mean, there's research that says 95% of what we're dealing with in our adult relationships is attachment-based and unconscious and knee-jerk reactions. I mean, when you find yourself saying, I'm never going to act like my mom or my dad, and all of a sudden you see yourself doing the exact same thing, it's kind of biologically predestined in a way for that to happen. So we want to give ourselves a lot of room for love and forgiveness and compassion. I think that's another message I really want to make sure I get across today. But ambivalent attachment, because they're so over, and this is wired in, another thing I want to say, it's wired in to our survival system. So it's not a thought process. Like, we don't have that story about it. You can't just say, well, I'm not going to be removing myself, withdrawing from relationship just to talk yourself out of it. We need these experiential healing experiences to be able to overcome those adaptations that were wired into our survival system. Same thing with ambivalent. There's your sense of survival, which means the threat level is that high. We have a fear of relaxing our overactivated attachment system because we really have this inbuilt belief that's physiologically embedded that our person that we're relying on is not going to be there. And that creates a lot of anxiety. We need a primary attachment system as little babies for sure, but we need it as adults too. We function much better when we have somebody who's really reliable, and hopefully we move more and more towards secure attachment in the relationship. The way that person will regulate their nervous system from an ambivalent point of view is they tend to over-focus on the other person. They have the blueprint installed in unconscious memory that the only way they can regulate is if the other person regulates them. So think about that. That's going to put a lot of pressure on friends or the therapist, if you're a therapist, or especially your relationship partner when you're in a relationship, to do it for you. Like, you have to have them hug you. You have to have them calm you down. You have to have them talk to you immediately when you're activated. That puts a lot of pressure on the other person. And so often what happens, it's really heartbreaking, is that a person that's stuck, you know, a lot in ambivalent attachment, again, you can have a mix or a little bit or a lot, they will put so much pressure on the other person to keep reassuring them and to keep regulating them that they often push the person they love the most away, because the person just is like, it's never enough. And the feeling actually is on the person that has the ambivalent attachment, it never feels like enough, because it keeps getting fueled by their history and they keep reverting to that original wound of, I'm going to get dropped. And you can imagine if your worldview is other people are going to drop me, even if they're being really kind and they're doing really wonderful things and they're really loving and they're like perfect, nobody is, it's never going to feel like enough because you've already abandoned yourself, right? So even if you get everything, there's no self-awareness, orientation to self to receive it. So a big part of that is like noticing caring behaviors, you tend not to, because it'll calm your nervous system down, your attachment system down. And then you get this trigger of survival, like, okay, I'm feeling good right now. But the next thing that happens in my sequence is the person disappoints me, betrays me, abandons me, drops me. And that has to get uncoupled, and that has to get solved. Otherwise, no matter how much love you get, the next thought you have is, it's not enough. It's not going to be there tomorrow. I can't trust it. So you see the difference, the different orientation to nervous system regulation, just between those two insecure attachment styles. So I want to take a breath and let you respond. And then I want to talk a little bit about disorganized attachment.
Well, already I'm starting to think of the different health issues that they're going to have, because you've already mentioned a few times, even with the avoiding, how much energy it takes to maintain that dismissive attitude towards their own biological needs of connection.
Right. It'd be just like if you tried to eradicate thirst or eradicate hunger. I mean, it's not going to work, right?
It's not going to work. And my goodness, yeah, like I'm already seeing the patterns that will persist. And I can see how these patterns would really show up in a lot of areas of their life, not just their relationships, but right, in health as well.
Well, to say a little bit more about that, one of the things I just read was that avoidant attachment is often linked to eating disorders. Because you think about it, it's a lack of nourishment. They aren't able to take nourishment relationally because it was either the person was gone, like nobody's home, which is terrifying to an infant, or the person was actively hateful, looked at them with hate, was rejecting, had a negative, you know, really negative energy, or angry all the time, or something like that. So that makes sense to me that they might have trouble with eating disorders because they have an issue with nourishment, relational nourishment. So that can get transferred to food. Makes total sense to me why that might be a link health-wise. So I just wanted to mention that while we're talking about it.
Yeah. And I can see all forms of eating disorders, right? Because some right. will, and maybe this is more of the preoccupied or the ambivalent, where they may go into more binge eating where they never feel like it's enough. And maybe the avoidant, it can tend to have more of that control around anorexia, and I'm not going to even let the nourishment in. Be fascinating to look deeper into that.
Yeah, because you look into bulimia, you're not letting the nourishment in either because you're regurgitating it, you know? So it's interesting. I think there's a lot of correlation in my mind anyway, with ambivalent to addiction because you're sort of addicted to an external reinforcement and you're trying to regulate externally. So if people are disappointing you and you're expecting people to drop you, right, then you can go to substances, you know, alcohol, drugs, exactly like you said with food. It has a similar, like, trying to get it from the outside versus learning how to regulate inside your body, right?
And yet even with that, I see the same cycle repeating itself as what mm-hmm. happens in the relationships, because that substance, whatever it is, will only last for so long. And so then they experientially have that same sequence happening where I feel good now, but the next thing that happens, it's going to drop me.
Right.
And of course that is going to happen when you're using an external substance or a person in order to give you that sense of regulation.
Exactly. So in a way, avoidant, when we're trying to look at a bit healing, because we're only focused on the healing part, they need to learn how to truly self-regulate. And also big deficit is co-regulation, because our nervous system from the beginning, I think even in utero, is designed to co-regulate. It's designed to regulate, you know, we're like absorbing the mother, we're regulating with the mother in utero, and then we're trying to do that as soon as we're born. And when you miss the opportunity because your mother, or maybe it's a medical condition, you're not able to co-regulate as a little one, and you then adapt to becoming more avoidant, your nervous system really doesn't even know how to do it. So later in treatment, or later in an adult relationship, or later in school, you know, somebody can be really available trying to hug you, but you just can't even quite feel comfortable in the hug. You don't quite know what to do with it. If you haven't been loved well, you know, or had that experience early on, so it gets patterned into your nervous system being able to receive it, there's a really hard time to take it in.
There's work that needs to be done before you can just automatically step into being present in the moment when someone loves on you. You've got to be able to know how to be embodied and
exactly.
present with yourself.
And fortunately, the field has moved in the direction of somatic therapies so much more. When I started, you even said the idea that the mind and body were connected, you were considered really a heretic. So, you know, we have somatic experiencing. We have a lot of body-based work now that people can do to really help themselves reconnect. And it's so important, especially after trauma. We don't just dissociate. I think what should be equally mentioned is when we dissociate, obviously, to protect ourselves from pain, is that we disconnect from ourselves, from our ground, from higher source, from our bodies, and from other people. And I think even as we learn to reconnect to ourselves, it's another whole learning of how do we connect relationally and really be there authentically.
So you've walked through the avoidant and the ambivalent.
Right. Let's okay. go to the next one.
Go to the next one.
Disorganized is definitely the most complex, because disorganized is in a way the extremes of avoidant and ambivalent, and kind of oscillating between the two strong reactions of shutdown, disconnection, or extreme neediness and really distressing, trying to connect and grab onto someone to help them regulate. And it sets up the first research they did on attachment was only about avoidant and ambivalent. And then they realized there was a whole category of kids in the strange studies and everything that weren't really fitting that MO. So they went further and they really understood that there was another whole category that doesn't have the same sequential. It's erratic. That's why it's harder to measure and harder to do research on, because it manifests in so many different ways. But it's called disorganized attachment. Some people call it type D, so that you might see it in the literature a little bit differently. But it as an adult, it's considered unresolved trauma. And it's because too often one or both parents or whoever was the caregiver was angry or really extremely chaotic or threatening. And so the child was, you know, their attachment system is telling them to reach out and bond and connect. And their threat response is saying, get the heck out of here, or hit the person, run, you know, fight or flight, or freeze. So a lot of times you would see kids, you know, the strange studies I'm sure everybody's familiar with, but they would take usually around a 18-month-old to 2-year-old. The mothers were usually available back in the 50s when they did the initial research on this, and they'd have a therapist in the room, and the mother would drop their infant off, and the therapist would stay to be there to make sure kid was safe, and the mother would leave, and they would like really measure and watch the reactions of the kids. And then when the mother came back, it's really more about a reunion study. What did the child do when the parent returned? So what would happen with avoidant is they would act like the mother didn't even, they would not have any difference. They would just act like nothing happened. They would ignore the mother. But then when they measured them physiologically, they were having a lot of physiological stress. because they were trying to keep their attachment system disconnected, right? They look like they were totally calm. Like people when they're dissociated look pretty calm, right? But you know, they're not, they're really highly activated. So that was important information. And then with ambivalent, they would, you know, go to mom and they'd scream and cry and they couldn't be soothed because they were just so upset by the separation. They just couldn't be calmed down. That was the ambivalent. But when they got to disorganized, finally did the research on that, the kid would like just run away, like run towards the parent, like halfway, and then turn around and run away. Really sad. Or they'd run toward the parent. There's the attachment system going, and they'd run up to the parent and hit him in the face, slap him in the face, which is a pretty dangerous thing to do, right? When you're an infant compared to an adult. And then, or they would just run, like they would start to go towards, and they would just freeze. They would go zombie. They would just stop and go like gone. So these are pretty severe reactions. And what they understood was happening was there was so much threat when the child was trying to create a relationship with the parent, or they're trying to create this attachment bond between them, that the child was really in a high threat response. So their experience is relationships are danger, like danger, danger, Will Robertson, you know, danger, 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 don't go there. So they would have the typical fight, flight, freeze reactions. And this is really important information, much harder to research because a child can be disorganized and avoidant. So whenever they get scared like that, when their attachment system comes up, and it'll show up in their adult relationships. I had this really wonderful, spiritually mature, done a million years of therapy person that I did a session with a long time ago now. She was a naturopath. She was a healer, really advanced. And she was getting married. She knew that this person she was marrying was this really great, securely attached, wonderful guy. She knew that intellectually. But as they got closer to the wedding, she started to have these really strong fear reactions to any interaction with him. And she was like, what's going on with me? I'm like terrified. And it didn't have anything to do with him. He wasn't doing anything. When we really went into it, it had to do with her early patterning with a mother who was bipolar and did really outrageous stuff, you know, was loving at some points, but it was also really did some really, really injurious things to the relationship. So as we cleared that up, then she could go into the wedding without this terror that was confusing him and confusing the heck out of her. So these are how these things can get imported and really cause havoc. And, you know, if you're not really astute to the dynamics, you can think, oh, well, my partner's not a good partner. And you could miss out on a really wonderful, healthy, and not like the person's perfect or anything, but really, really good opportunity to have love in your life. I feel like it's so important for us to have at least the basic information so that we can start to compassionately understand ourselves and our partners. If you're disorganized, avoidant, you'll tend to, when that threat gets really strong, your main response will be to disconnect and dissociate and withdraw. You know, the ghost a person. Like sometimes people will get really close and then the neck they get close and then they ghost. That's an avoidant pattern. You know, then the other person's thinking, oh, we're getting closer. The relationship's deepening. And then all of a sudden, you know, they have this really intimate evening or wonderful Valentine's Day or whatever. And then the next thing is they don't hear from the person for 6 weeks. That's an avoidant reaction. And that's very confusing. You know, you get really cuddly and yummy and all of a sudden the person's gone. And if you're ambivalent, that's going to trigger you the heck out of you because you're always, that's like a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? So you can just get into a spiral so easily in these dynamics if you don't understand them. And, you know, of course, again, like learning how to embody, it takes work to get back. You can also have disorganized ambivalence. So that means when you hit that really deep terror, it triggers you into excessive clinginess. Like you just, I've had situations where clients have grabbed my ankles in the session, you know, and so it's a very strong response. And we need, as therapists or just human beings, we need to understand that's coming from this wound and not to like think poorly of someone because they have that reaction. And then, of course, you can have a disorganized, ambivalent, and avoidant where you oscillate between the extreme withdrawal and perhaps the extreme neediness or clinginess. So it's a rocky ride. It's definitely complex trauma because complex trauma basically means a traumatic event that could happen in your adulthood, like a car accident or surgery or, you know, a death of a loved one or something. And then early developmental trauma. So it'll bring that trauma is traumatic enough, but then it brings with it this whole history of developmental trauma attached to it. So we need to understand how to work with episodic trauma, but also how to work with the early development, early attachment history trauma that sometimes is mixed in or glued to it.
Well, and what I found is that as long as there's developmental trauma, it doesn't matter what traumas happen later in life. When you work on that, you're going to have elements of the development.
Yes. It's like a package deal, you know, and sometimes you have to kind of make a clinical decision if you're going to address the developmental piece first or the episodic first. And there's different ways to evaluate that, but they both eventually need to be addressed because sometimes you work with one and then it makes it easier to work with the other. And sometimes if you don't work with the one, other one first, you can't get anywhere with the other one, you know? So it's an important understanding to have. And when people are trying to regulate, because that was your original question with the nervous system's all over the place because it'll spike up into too much sympathetic when they're overactivated into the ambivalent part. And that'll bring panic attacks or rage outbursts or, you know, excessive overactivation, feeling electrical in your body, perhaps. And then it'll drop all the way into overactivated parasympathetic, or if you think of Stephen Porges' polyvagal work, it'd be dorsal vagal response, where you shut down, your digestion goes haywire, and get IBS or alternate between diarrhea or constipation, or have one or both of them stabilize like that. Or you can have lethargy, no energy, like chronic fatigue, kind of Epstein-Barr kind of things, and dissociation, and just like everything's turned off. You just like gone in a way, you know, so they can oscillate between those two, or you can just have a pattern where you just go completely shut down, or you completely go into anxiety and panic and rage. So it's a heavy duty situation. So safety is super important when working with disorganized attachment, because safety has been so off the table. And so often people have not had really feel like they ever felt safe. I mean, it's hard to imagine. Yes. And when's the first time you felt safe? And they said, I don't think I even know what that is, because they've been raised with emotional abuse or sexual abuse or ongoing physical abuse or physical and emotional neglect. Also causes it. The nervous system just needs a lot of learning how to go into this sort of range of resiliency. And I think Dan Siegel calls it window of tolerance, to start to learn how to manage those arcs when it goes too much sympathetic, to like calm that panic down. And so it comes back within that, what I call range of resiliency. And then also how to lift the brake on the attachment system and the nervous system to deal with the too much parasympathetic that goes down into the depression or the disconnection or the digestion problems and the lethargy. And you know that you don't go all the way in, you just go a little bit below and then keep lifting the brake to bring the aliveness back. And not that you want to keep the range of resiliency consistent. You eventually, I don't know how to do this backwards, but you eventually want to widen it, you know, so that you have this much starting out maybe, and then you want to keep growing it, that resiliency in the body and in the ability to be in a relational field over time. And it's definitely buildable. It's like working out your muscles. You can work out your nervous system and your increase your range of resiliency really in an amazing amount, you know, and that includes boundary work and all sorts of the somatic work. But also I think what needs to happen with it is the relational work.
Thank you for speaking to and ending with the hope, Diane. We can work out those muscles of our nervous system and create the resilience, boundaries, and relational patterns for a secure attachment. Thank you. It's always so good to talk with you and about such an important topic. And thank you for tuning in to this episode of the Biology of Trauma podcast.
As we learn all this information, I want you to remember that no matter what our early experiences were, because our nervous system still continues to adapt to life experiences, that we can create new experiences now that are ones of safety, that are ones of us loving ourselves, that surround ourselves with an external environment of safety, an internal environment of safety, and we can actually change our biology, change our physiology as a result of that. Now, of course, as we talk about attachment, it will also be important at some point for you to bring in neurodevelopment. And that means that at some point, just like my professionals and the Biology of Trauma Professional Training Program, you may need to get on your belly and do some tummy time and some tummy crawling in order to help rewire an insecure attachment style. Because we have that capacity now. We have these tools. We have this knowledge. We know what to do to create new experiences, different experiences for ourselves around relationships, around attunement, around love and safety in relationships. So I hope that this interview has not only left you with a deeper understanding of yourself, but more importantly, is leaving you with that clarity of, oh yeah, I've got some work to do and it's possible.
it is possible to experience significant change in our life, in our relationships, in our health when we do this work and we have the knowledge, we have the tools to be able to rewire some of this early programming. I have some helpful links and resources for you in the show notes so that you have whatever you need, whatever next level of step that you are ready to take to address a biology of insecurity and reprogram those attachment pains and even neurodevelopmental gaps. I have written a whole guide to share an attachment trauma roadmap with you for what the healing journey looks like. It's some of the most important work you can do to be a better person, parent, practitioner. And this guide is called the Attachment Trauma Roadmap for Rewiring and Healing. I will have that link in the show notes for you. If you are ready to actually start your journey to rewire and repair attachment pain, remember, it is not actually safe for us to process our childhood until we have a foundation of regulation first. We do that through 3 weeks of somatic work, followed by 3 weeks of somatic parts work. And you need this foundation of regulation. And I will have the link to the foundational journey where many, many have started their attachment healing journey with me. This will be something that will already start to change your biology. If you are interested in more information on attachment, I will include the links to the top downloaded podcasts on this topic. Podcast number 14 is How to Not Traumatize Your Infant with the Common Parenting Practices. That's with guest Betty Lamont. Podcast number 59 was on adoption trauma, the myth of resilience. Podcast number 44, how quickly can lifelong patterns change when we start to connect with our body and respond and give it what it needs? Speaking of top favorite episodes, would you please take a moment to rate this episode? When you give it a 5 out of 5 rating, it helps other people know it is worth their time to listen to as well. It also helps me know what you like and to give you more of what you want to learn. With that, I'm Dr. Amy, your host for this Biology of Trauma podcast. Until next episode, lots of love. Thank you for joining me today. If you enjoyed today's show, be sure to subscribe. We definitely will learn, laugh, and sometimes cry together on this healing journey, and you won't want to miss an episode. Give my podcast 5 stars, share it with a friend or colleague. If you felt an impact as it truly helps get the word out and breaking the paradigm of how we do trauma work. I look forward to seeing you back here next week. Until then, this is your host, Dr. Amy, sending you lots of love.